Hey, good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started here, so if you can take your places, get your coffee. So I guess as was mentioned last night, either your sponsor forced you to be here or you have no life, or you're an early bird. But good morning. My name is Catherine, and I am an alcoholic. And I would like to welcome you all here this morning. We're really glad you're here. This is the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're doing this special event where we've asked Rich B to come in and Jerry to come in and share their experience, strength, and hope on the steps with you. So last night we went over powerless and made a decision, and this morning we'll start with inventory and the fun stuff. So for those who care to join us, let's start this morning with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So the Simple Actions Group again wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. These premises are non-smoking. You can't smoke outside. Just please move as far away as possible from the front door. There are butt cans for you to use, so no cigarette butts on the ground, please. And there are bathrooms right outside across this foyer. There's a small flight of stairs. And at this time, please make sure your cell phones are silenced. So we'll check that while we have a moment here. And while we're in the first session this morning, we'll go to about 10:15. Please try to remain seated as to not interrupt those who might be listening. And I'll just let you know that this group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness, and purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a clear set of directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. And these actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this session this weekend to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism based on AA simple actions. So real quick, I'll just read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, and neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format today, you may have some of these orange flyers, but again, our first session will go to about 10:15 on inventory. And the speakers have graciously agreed to share their experience here with you today. So I hope you enjoy it. Is there anyone here that is in their first 30 days of sobriety? Okay. All right. Let's support each other and our speakers. Let's welcome Jerry Wade.
All right. Jerry Weaver, alcoholic.
Jerry.
Sobriety day, July 2nd, 1989. Home group is a group called There Is a Solution. Yep. Simple Actions is a good name, but it's not as good as There's a Solution. So, that's a good name, but I think There's a Solution. They wrote a chapter about us in the big book. I don't know if you've ever read that or seen that anywhere, but it's in the book in there. But good to be here this morning. Good to be sober and to be in my right mind and to be amongst friends. If I'm assuming if you're here this morning, it's probably because you want to be. Maybe not because your sponsor told you to or that you don't have much of a life.
I'm so sorry.
What? No, I said that. I think that's why some people come. But most folks that show up for something like this, it's because they really are interested in their own recovery. And they're interested in, you know, getting a stronger hold on, on their alcoholism and interested in going a little, you know, beyond just going to meetings. So I appreciate people that show up for stuff like this. I know that it's done nothing but help me to be involved in all aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous. I read a lot of AA history. I talk to a lot of people, and I love the early stories of our kind of pioneers of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm always kind of amazed at how simple the program was. I still think it can be that simple. But when you read stories, and even in the big book, and read other stories about people when they got sober, a really good example in the book is Alcoholics Number Three. Alcoholic Number Three, right? He basically took an inventory sitting in the hospital, and he basically shared that with himself and with Bill and Bob when they came and visited him on that third day or fourth day, whatever that was, and shared his deficiencies with them, and immediately got out of the hospital and started making amends. And it worked for him. The guy stayed sober all of his life. Bill Wilson, same thing, right? He was in the hospital and kind of gave his life to God in the hospital and shared his deficiencies and his shortcomings, or his sins, as he called them, I think, in the book, with Ebby when he came back. Guy stayed sober the rest of his life. There's a good story in there about he sold himself short in the big book. Guy spent 3 or 4 hours with Dr. Bob in his office on Dr. Bob's day off, and they went through the six-step program as it was at that time. And in about 3 or 4 hours, he did an inventory and shared his defects and his shortcomings with Dr. Bob, and went on and started a meeting in Chicago. And if you try to do stuff like that today, people want to laugh at you or tell you that you can't do that. And I'd submit to you that it's that simple. Now, I'm a guy that there was a period of time, it's been a while, that I got real mechanical with 4-step. And I wasn't originally sponsored that way. And I could give you some really nice diagrams and pick apart words and all that, I guess, has its place. But we won't do that for you this morning. That's really not what it's about. And a lot of the guys that I sponsor nowadays, they come in and they think that the steps are like some checklist. Did that one, and they're going to run off to the next one and did that one. And it's more about just kind of checking it off and saying that I did it. And really, for me, the 4th through the 9th step, it's about having an experience, and it's about truly trying to get at the root of my selfishness and my self-centeredness, and getting at the root of what I did to cause all the problems in my life. And if I don't look at it as a spiritual exercise, sometimes I can miss the point of it. Now, I'm a guy, before I got sober, I don't recall ever taking my inventory. I recall taking a lot of other people's inventory, and I mean, I was a guy that just blamed everything on other people. I mean, it was always somebody else's fault. From my earliest memory, it was somebody else's fault. You know, it was my dad's fault for moving me around a lot and fooling around on my mom. If that didn't happen, then, you know, I wouldn't be the way that I was. And, you know, my mom loved my brother more than she loved me, and you know, that was obvious to everybody, and it just traumatized me as a kid. You know, none of that stuff was really true. And everything that happened, I mean, every time I got in trouble with the law, every time I got in trouble with authority, every time I got kicked out of something, I could always point back to it being somebody else's fault. And, you know, what I had nothing to do with it. And I kind of brought that into AA, and the story in the big book, the actor that acts like the director, right, it's right before the 3rd step in the book. That thing nails me. Now, when I was sober a couple of weeks and I read that, I didn't fully understand it. It wasn't until after I did an inventory and a 5th step that I kind of understood what that meant. And then the longer I stayed sober, boy, I really started to come to understand what it meant. But, you know, that was my life. I mean, I was a guy that that would be real kind and real polite to you, but I always had a hidden motive. I wanted something on the back end of it. And that was just kind of how I operated. If you'd asked me, I'd have told you, yeah, I'm a pretty nice guy, pretty honest guy. None of that was true. Because I was always out to get something. There was always a selfish end to it. And then when you didn't act like I wanted you to, or you didn't give me what I wanted, then I would revert to getting mad, getting angry, getting indignant, and, you know, cussing at you or fighting you or you know, disregarding you. And that was just a vicious cycle. I mean, that was, you know, that was my life was just one, you know, episode after another like that. And the more that I fought, the worse things got. And I didn't understand that. And I was another guy that didn't. I mean, I thought that you were supposed to, like, judge people and that you were supposed to keep score. I mean, that was just kind of how it was. I didn't know that. As a matter of fact, when it was first presented to me in the third step that, hey, you know what, you can give up managing other people's lives and you can just let people be who they were, I actually was relieved, man. I was like, I want to sign up for that because, I mean, that way I didn't have to keep score in my head. And, I knew exactly what you had done and you know, what I was going to do to you. I knew exactly what you had done, and it was just as exhausting trying to keep up with all that stuff. And I didn't know that you could actually just let people be who they were and that you could just accept some things and you didn't have to constantly judge and constantly keep score. And, you know, I'm a guy that did my first fourth step. I guess I was about 3 weeks sober, 4 weeks sober. And it's very similar to this kind of the stories in the book. I mean, I was told, hey, if you got a problem and you want to recover, this is how we do it. And that you need to hurry up and get on with the spiritual program of action if you're going to make it. And, you know, it was explained to me that idea, that fundamental idea of God was inside of me. And that I covered that up through living the way that I live, through, you know, constantly being full of fear and being full of resentment, full of anger, that I covered it up by all the stuff that I put into my body. And I covered it up by being overly selfishness and selfish and self-centered and just this over-concentration on myself. And that the purpose of the, you know, 4 through 9 was to try to get all that stuff out of me and to uncover that stuff so that spirit that was inside of, that power that's inside, could come to life. And that's what that spiritual awakening was. And I don't know if I fully understood all that at the time, but, you know, that I was kind of taught that the purpose of that fourth step is to disclose those things inside me that block me off from God, block me off from people. And because, you know, when I got here, just like, you know, most everybody, I mean, I was just at odds with the world. I was at odds with people. And I couldn't have a meaningful or a healthy relationship with anybody because of the things that were inside of me. And, you know, and I was also told, we talked about it last night, that, you know, the best way to do the first three steps is the way you turn your will and life over to God is really steps 4 through 9. And that those are actions against my will. Those are actions against what I think, feel, and believe. Because I don't want to look at myself, right? There's nothing wrong with me. It's you. And, you know, I had, the first time I wrote the first four step that I wrote, I mean, it was not exactly the format in the book. I can you believe it? I still stayed sober. Man, I can't believe that. I'm here. It was close, though. And but what happened to me when I started writing that stuff down? I mean, I was just this, you know, a huge victim, and woe is me. And when I started writing down those resentments I had and started asking myself some of those questions about where was I selfish and where was I dishonest and where was I at fault, where was I to blame, I had just writing it, for me, I had somewhat of a spiritual experience in that it was the first time in my life that I actually saw that most of the people that I had blamed my life on had done nothing but try to help me. And I just continued to blame them. I continued to look at what they were doing and what they were not doing instead of what they actually did to help me. And, you know, for the very first time in my life, I realized that most of the resentments that I had at people were made up in my mind. I mean, it was just stuff that I just made up and stuff. Most of it wasn't based on any fact or any real series of events. It was just stuff that I conjured up in my mind. And one of the things that was really, really helpful for me was there's a prayer in the book. And there's a kind of a little exercise there that says that we try to realize that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. And, you know, that was one of the things that, for me, it was somewhat profound in that I started to realize that, you know what, all those people, you know, they were doing the best that they could. And that kind of, you know, we say that a lot in AA, and sometimes we mean it and we don't mean it, but it actually had an impact on me. Then I started to realize that, my God, I did all kinds of things wrong, and I made all kinds of mistakes, and people let me off the hook. People forgave me. People still tried to help me, and yet I don't want to pass that same level of love and tolerance on to other people. And so it really, really helped me to realize that, you know, all those things I blamed my dad on, he was just doing the best he could do. You know, and, you know, my God, I started thinking about, you know, neither one of my parents made it past the ninth grade. And both of them grew up in really, really rough, tough conditions. I mean, stuff that I couldn't even imagine having to do. And they were basically, you know, kids having kids, you know. And Mom started having babies when she was 15. And I started to realize that, man, they were doing the best they could do. That here I am, not a whole lot wrong with me, really, and that they had actually done a pretty good job of trying to take care of me. But it was their fault, you know, that I was where I was at. And that stuff started to shift a little bit, and I started to realize that I'm the one that made a lot of the decisions that put me where I was at. And through that prayer in there, I started to realize that I got to focus on myself. I got to focus on my demonstration. I got to focus on what did I do, and take the focus off of them. And that prayer in the book is really, it's actually for us. You hear a lot of people talking about, well, I'm going to pray for this person to get all these things, or that's not what that prayer in the fourth step says. It's asking God to show me how to practice tolerance and patience and pity. It's asking God to save me from being angry. And I do that so that I can disregard what I think people have done to me and look at what I did. And for me, that prayer was very, very powerful in letting people off the hook and really practicing some forgiveness for others and focusing on what I did. And, you know, I was a guy that didn't have, when I got here, if you'd asked me if I was afraid of anything, no, I'm not afraid of nothing. And would believe that. And, you know, my whole life was riddled with fear. I mean, you know, when I got honest about it, my earliest memory was fear. And I don't remember ever waking up any morning without being consumed with fear and consumed about what's going to happen today and who's going to find out and who's coming to get me, and they're out there and I don't know who they are, but I know that they're coming. And matter of fact, I was sober about 18 years before I realized that the boogeyman actually doesn't exist. It was a long time. But when I started writing out fears, you know, a lot of them started losing their power over me. And it was just like the resentments that I had at people. When I started writing that stuff out, it started losing its power. I mean, that's one of the importance for me of writing stuff down. I mean, it's one thing to talk about it to somebody, but when I start writing it down, typically I'm a little more truthful and honest when I write. And when I start writing stuff, for me, it just starts losing its power. And a lot of stuff even starts, in some cases, is almost comical or very kind of like, you look at it and you're like, man, I'm really immature, right? When you start writing some of that stuff down, you're like, and especially when you write it and then you leave it for a while and you come back and you read it, you're like, whoa, really? And then you want to shred it real quick or burn it so nobody can see it. I'm not sharing this with anybody. But I realized that my life was just riddled with fear, and that every decision I made was based in fear. I got married the first time at a young age because I was afraid to tell the girl that I didn't want to get married. I mean, absolutely the truth. Right? I went into the Air Force mostly to avoid going to jail, but I didn't want to go to the Air Force, and I did because I was afraid to make a different decision. I was afraid to tell somebody, hey, I'd rather do this. And, you know, everything, I mean, every decision I made was based in what I thought somebody was going to think or what I thought somebody was going to, you know, do. And a lot of the decisions that I didn't make was because of fear and worried about failing and worried about, man, what's going to happen if I don't measure up? What are they going to think? And, you know, all that stuff was none of it was real. It was just stuff that I made up in my mind. And when I wrote that stuff down, and, you know, it started to lose its power. And the thing that happened to me, though, when I wrote all that out the very first time was, it was just, it really hit me that I was really not a victim anymore. And that, again, that most people that I had come into contact with, I had dirtied them somehow through my actions or through my words. And that most of those folks never deserved it, and that most of them had really done nothing but try to help me. And when I shared that with somebody, that, I don't know, I was 4 or 5 weeks sober when I did that first fifth step. Excuse me. I had a similar experience to the book. I mean, I didn't have a blinding light experience or a burning bush experience. But when I got done with that fifth step and shared that with a guy and got all that stuff out, it was really the first time in my life. And I don't want to imply that I was, like, done with the program, but when I finished that fifth step, it was like the first thing in my life that I ever actually completed, that I ever actually sat down and said, I'm going to do this and finish it, and I actually completed it. And I was like a lot of alcoholics. I was a good starter on stuff, but I never finished anything. Man, nothing. I'd start all kinds of stuff. I mean, I'd have all these good intentions, and I'd go into it all hot and heavy and pumped up, and I'd fizzle out quick. And I mean, I was inconsistent. I never showed up for anything. And there was this sense of accomplishment. But more importantly for me, I felt like for the first time that maybe this will work. I felt like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I was, and I hate to, not words that we normally use in AA, but I was a full-fledged member of the program. And that you know, that maybe that what we have here could help and basically save my life. And I left there knowing that I had done something good. And I left there knowing that I was an immature kid that never took responsibility for anything. And that my life, and literally this was about 5 weeks sober. I mean, I had this realization that my life was, and what happened from that point on was actually up to me. That I had to quit relying on my parents to bail me out. I had to quit relying on my father-in-law to help me out with things. I had to quit relying on all these people. I needed to take responsibility for my own actions. I needed to take accountability for my life. And that was for me, it was a profound thing, because I was a guy that, man, everything, it was always somebody else's responsibility. Yeah. Ain't got money to pay the bills. Well, one of you guys should pay this bill for me, right? Car's broke down. Well, Dad, you should come over here and fix this car. I mean, what's your problem? You know, and you know, I got all these, you know, trouble at the courthouse. Well, you guys should pay for the attorney to help me out here. I mean, come on, what's the deal? And I realized that all that stuff was, that had to stop. And all I did was use people. And all I did was expect people to do stuff for me. I loved self-pity. And I love making people feel sorry for me, and I love making things worse than what they are. And I love exaggerating the circumstances of my life. So you know, grandma or mommy or daddy or somebody will come in and say, oh, we feel so sorry for you, son. We're going to help you out. And, I mean, I was a master at that. And, you know, I realized that all that stuff, you know, that it was wrong and that it needed to stop. And, you know, I went on from there and did 6 and 7 and then went on into the amends that we'll talk about in a little while. But, and I've done other four steps since then, or I've done other inventories, but none of them as good as that first one. And it was just looking back on it, it wasn't the Sermon on the Mount or anything spectacular. It was just I had a desire to get honest. I had a desire to change. And I did the best that I could do, and it was sufficient. And, you know, as I stayed sober, and as, you know, I continued to grow up and my life started to change, I started really to understand what it talks about in the book about, you know, identifying things inside me that blocked me off. I didn't fully understand that when I was newly sober. But I understand it today that it's important for me to identify things inside of me that block me off from God, that block me off from other people, that block me off from being successful in all areas of my life. And, you know, that's really what that is. And now I'm not a guy I've been a part of some of that stuff, but nowadays we can get real caught up in inventory and get almost paralyzed. And we want to constantly inventory stuff and constantly inventory this and what's wrong with me, and I stumped my big toe. What am I doing wrong? And, you know, I was telling John, people just get all dramatic over the craziest things, you know, I fell off a ladder. What's going on? What am I doing wrong? What do I got to do to stop this? And I call it analysis paralysis, that we can get so caught up in inventorying and looking and looking and looking that we miss the point of really what we're supposed to be doing is just living life and trying to grow as we do that. And certainly that, you know, we're going to make mistakes or we're going to make bad decisions, but we just got to get over that and learn from them and move on. And if I constantly stay caught up in inventory and analysis of myself, then it's hard to live life. It's hard to be free. And that's, you know, that's what happened to me when I did that first, honest, fourth, and fifth step was I started to become free. It was the first real tangible evidence of walking away from that crazy, busted life and moving on to freedom and moving on to something better. Because I was, you know, I didn't realize at the time, but I was a slave to all those things that I thought people did to me. And it's like a boat anchor. It's like a chain that just, you know, that ties me and binds me from, prevents me from moving forward. And if I don't acknowledge it and deal with it and cut it, then I just stay stuck. So that's what happened to me in that first, fourth, and fifth step, was I started the process of becoming free of the past and the process of realizing that I wasn't a victim and that I needed to take responsibility for my actions. You know, it hit me pretty hard. So thank you.
Morning, everybody. Rich Bruckner, alcoholic. I could just sit there and listen to him all day. I like that. I think what we're talking about today, at least for me, it is the new way of life. This sober living comes through everything that we're going to talk about today. The only bad inventory, you know, is the one not taken. These are all, I just look at them as like life skills or spiritual tools. I mean, this is the new way of living that you all taught me, that everything I'm going to talk about today is virtually new vocabulary to me from Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I the self-examination, I have never said those words before AA. Like, I was never sitting in the bar or anywhere else going, you know, well, let's look at my part in it. I mean, just that phrase, you know, we pick up these phrases in AA like we've been using them our whole lives, and it's a good thing that they become such a functioning part of our vocabulary, but it's because I've developed a manner of living, right, which enables me to become somebody different. And let's face it, that you know, we don't have to do that. The only requirement for membership, I'm not, you know, I'm not an idiot, I've read the traditions, is a desire to stop drinking. But I also know that, let's face it, we've got all kinds of members. I mean, that's not a real stringent membership requirement. I belong to some other organizations, a lot of them, that have a heck of a lot higher bar, so to speak, than AA, right? You say you're a member, you're a member. And because of that, we've got all kinds of members. We've got pot smoking members. We've got members that get 24-hour chips every couple weeks. We've got pill taking members, dope smoking members, rotating members, lifetime sober members, helpful members, members that never do anything. And we got it all, right? And they're all equal members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the book does talk about a different set of requirements for sober membership. And the book says, who cares, right? Who cares for this process of inventory, self-examination, self-searching, it calls it. Who cares for self-searching, the leveling of pride? Not me. I mean, that's what we're talking about today. And it tells me right off the bat that I'm not going to be much interested in it. Who cares for the self-searching, leveling of our pride, confession of our shortcomings, that the process requires for its successful consummation? And Jim looked at me and said, you've got a lot of those 24-hour chips. Are you interested in becoming a successful sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, yes, I am. And that is a whole different group of standards than the traditions. And I became interested in becoming one of these guys that are a long-term sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's seems to be, according to the book, what we're talking about today. The mechanics of it for me, this inventory started for me in that federal penitentiary. How it started for me, I didn't know about this writing. I didn't know about the outline. I didn't know about columns. I didn't know about any of that. But what happened for me, and I say that specifically because it happened for me, was I'm sitting in that penitentiary, and God surrounded me with enough of me during that 9 months of sitting in that federal penitentiary that I was able to see me for the first time. I was able to start this self-examination without even knowing what I was doing or what it was called, by the way that God set it up. And the way that it happened for me is when he surrounded me with guys like me, we'd be out in the yard for the day, and there's a couple thousand men in that penitentiary. It's I believe it holds 1,800 men. 1,799 of those men were innocent. And I was the only one in there that was guilty. And that was a huge revelation to somebody like me. And what happened was all day in the yard, these guys would tell stories like I've told my whole life. They'd say things like, the reason that I'm in here is because of my mechanic. And if my mechanic had fixed that taillight on my car, the cop would have never pulled me over. And if the cop would never have pulled me over, he wouldn't have smelled the alcohol on my breath. And if he hadn't smelled the alcohol on my breath, he'd have never asked me to step out of the car, search the trunk, and find the dope. So you can see that the reason I'm in here serving this 20 years is because of my mechanic. And when I get out of here, if I find him, we're going to get this straightened out. And if I'd have hooked that guy up to a lie detector, he'd have absolutely passed it. He believed he was in there because of his mechanic. And I'm in here, another guy said, I'm in here because of my wife. And if she hadn't done what she did, you know, I wouldn't have had to get in that fight in the kitchen and grab the knife and you know, and he absolutely, if I'd have hooked him up, he believed that. He's in there because of his wife. And what happened in being in the midst of that, I just had this inward thing happening. The more I heard from them these stories that were like stories that I told, I was able to see me for the first time. And that I was where I was because of who I was. And I was who I was because of how I live. And I repeat that because that's a huge deal for a knucklehead of my variety. I was where I was because of who I was. I was who I was because of how I live. And I realized for the first time in my life in that penitentiary that my tombstone's not going to say, here lies Rich Bruckner, he meant well. Because I always meant well. It just didn't, my actions didn't indicate that. The outcomes never looked that way, but I did. There was never a night in my life where on a Friday night I'm taking that, you know, pregame shower. You guys know Friday nights, you're off work, little money came in maybe, payday, and I'm in the shower. You got the pregame beer in the shower. It's coming down. I mean, nothing's better. Cold beer, hot shower, getting out of that shower, put on a nice shirt, spray on a little girl sauce, you know, big plans for the evening. And You know, you say, hey, Rich, what are you up to tonight? Hey, tonight's the night that I'm going to shame my little sister to the point where she doesn't speak to me for 6.5 years. What are you up to tonight? I never left the house with that goal. Hey, what are you up to tonight? Well, tonight's the night that I'm going to embarrass my mother. To really put the icing on the cake to where mom can't look at me without her eyes dropping to the ground. Her only son, that she can't look me in my face for about a decade. You got any plans tonight? What do you hope to accomplish? You know, I never left the house with but that's what happened. You know, that's what I'm bringing to the table in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is a huge deal for somebody like me to actually realize, you know, in a penitentiary to start to accept accountability for my actions and in AA language to see my part in it, that I'm where I was because of what I do, you know, how I live life. And that's no small deal. And that's a God deal. That's a God inventory. You know, like I wasn't even familiar with this stuff. So if it came down to mechanics, I too would be drunk. Because I didn't know about how to, you know, do a perfect inventory or anything like that. But I believe that that's where the process of self-examination and this whole concept of looking at myself and truly inside understanding who and what I am and why my life keeps turning out like it does over and over was starting to sink in. When I got to that place in the program and I'd made that decision that I'm just going to do whatever, basically I'm going to just do what you tell me to do, because that was the only part of I'd never approached AA like that. I'm just going to do what you tell me to do. He said that we write down these resentments, and I have this other thing about me that one of my biggest fears is that you'll know that I don't know something, right? And it's I like that show on TV that's got like the man code, and that's like the worst thing for a man. You know, you can't know that I don't know. I have to seem like I know everything, or at least invent something. And I go through life like that, and I say things like, I have a story that I kind of believe, but not really. I get to AA, and by this point, things are starting to happen by the time I get to step four. And I too did it with somewhat urgency. I think I was about 40 some days sober. I'd come out of the hospital after that not working out, and I, you know, got my sponsor, made the decision to go ahead through with the process. So I know I wasn't more than, you know, 2-3 months sober the first time I did this. And I view the first time through these steps, whether they're mechanical in nature, or it just doesn't even matter how you do them that first time. To me, it was like triage. It was just to stop the bleeding enough that I didn't, you know, die immediately. And that's the only set of urgency for somebody like me. I know that I can only stay sober for so long without getting some of that stuff out. And there's short fuse guys and gals and longer fuse guys and gals. I can make it roughly a couple of weeks without the process. And he would point that out. You know, the only time frame on a four-step, you just have to do it before you die. But other than that, take your time, you know. And that first time through, that's what I needed to do, was to get enough of that out and get as honest as I could, the best I could, to not have to, you know, kill myself with another drink or pills or whatever else I was going to do to take myself out sober in that awful state of, you know, I'm not drinking and not changing. And that's like the most dangerous place to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, is that period of time. And from all of that education stuff around alcoholism, I do know the figure is that 92% of alcoholics that commit suicide, we do it sober. When we're drunk, we're all right. We're not thinking about the shame and the remorse and the guilt and the God, that just, I've just screwed this thing up so bad. That happens in those periods of, you know, sobriety, right? And that's I got to do something about it. And this inventory lets me do that. And you know, he said, write down resentments. And I told you, I can't tell you that I don't know what something means. So I say, well, I don't have any of those. And he said, okay, that's fine. I could see that. So just go home, write down who you hate and why you hate them. And I said, oh, you should have said so. That's easy. And, you know, and I start firing that out. And, you know, my buddy and I last night got to start that right here. A new friend of mine had, you know, just getting started on the inventory. And I'm just right down here, you hate him and why you hate him. And it turns out we're really good at that. I mean, that's what we do during smoke breaks, right? Outside the meeting, after the meeting, in the clubhouse, at dinner. I mean, that's what, no doubt, you're going, you know, guy Jerry's got a beautiful full head of hair, you know, almost 50, you know. Who the hell does he think he is? Comes here from North Carolina to tell us about AA in Virginia. You know, that's a... And who, bald guy from Ocean City. I mean, write it down. Bald guy from Ocean City, you know. Why thinks he's sober, says that there's another set of requirements for sober membership. I didn't like the way that sounded. Write it down. That's it. I mean, what we do right out front, that's it. It is no deeper than that. I'm a big believer on the flip side of that. I've gotten to hear a lot of fifth steps and becoming a... I think that the fourth step inventory is as good as the listener. And I like to do inventory with just about anybody that'll listen. If I respect you and your sobriety, I want to do some inventory with you at some point. Because each person I've had the privilege of doing that with, that's a good fifth step partner, pulls something out of me that I didn't know. You know, because they're listening. I've learned to listen for what's not being said, right? You know, hey, Jerry, I noticed we've gone through, 15 names here. What about your mother? You've never talked about your mother. She's not on any list. We're on year 25. I've heard four inventories. Everybody I know has a mother. Oh, well, I'm not mad at her. I've never known her since birth. Oh, really? She just split when I was born. Okay, Mom, split when I was born. Sounds like we're getting to something, right? And then, before you know it, I'm crying, right? I'm going, she left. She left me, right? Like, there's this thing. So, the fifth step listener, I think, is equally as important, and we don't talk about that a lot, you know, listening for what's not being said, and you all have been so good at doing that for me, because I live in this self-delusion. I say things, I have this little job by this point, and things are starting to change in my life, in my sobriety. I'm sweeping the floor in a picture frame shop. It's my first sober job, and I'm making $6.25 an hour. And a little's becoming a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm starting to go to meetings that I didn't like to go to, the ones that have this book up front and the ones that are talking about steps. And, you know, the one I used to come into a meeting, and if I'd see this, I'd leave because I knew what you guys were going to talk about. And I was like, oh, man, I went to the wrong meeting. And I'd go find a group that was talking about their day and how do you feel and, you know, maybe my favorite topic, like relationships, because we're all so good at them. And the group sits around, and, you know, does anybody have a topic? And, you know, Bob is like, you know, she left me again. And it's been Bob's topic for, like, the last 5 years. And, you know, then we go around the room, and everybody shares their sage wisdom on relationships. And, you know, he calls on his buddy Frank, who knows a lot, because Frank's been married and divorced 6 times. You know, he's got a lot to offer us. And, you know, and I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous knowing no more about recovery from this fatal disease than the second that I walked in, but maybe I'm a better dater or something. And, but now things are starting to kind of inwardly change, right, at this point in my sobriety, and I'm strangely drawn to some people I didn't used to like in AA or becoming likable. I don't know if anybody's had that experience, and some of the people I used to think were just great, I'm starting to keep a little distance, you know, maybe I don't need to go to the pool hall and smoke weed out back anymore, you know, like the things are just starting to change, my picture of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would tell stories, you know, that guy would give me my paycheck at that little picture frame shop, and it was like 200 and some bucks a week, man. And a little became a lot. That's the other thing. Anybody notice that? A little comes a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. When we focus on the spiritual, the material always takes care of itself. It just happens that way. And when I do it the other way around, which is how I'd always approach life, was like, if I could just get enough money in the bank. I mean, there's people in this room that I promise have this plan. When I get X amount of money in the savings account, then I'm going to get really spiritual. I mean, I'm going to have time to go to retreats every weekend. I'm going to go to these AA functions. I'm going to go to AA conferences. I'm going to take a full hour and a half in the morning for prayer and meditation. I'm going to have all kinds of time once I get X amount of, right? And it's like the secret plan in AA that we don't talk about. I'm going to get spiritual when, right? And so I would say things. He'd give me my paycheck, and I'd have to go to those. I'll probably offend somebody. I'd go to those, I call them the loser check cashing places, because that's where I had to go. I don't have a bank account. And he would say, you know, they take like 5% of your paycheck for not having a bank account. It's like a loser penalty. Like, you're such a loser, Rich, you can't have a bank account, so we're going to take part of your paycheck just to cash it because you suck that bad. And that's what I got going on inside of me, and I can't tell you that. So this guy I'm working for, Dan, would say, how come you don't go to, why don't you just put that in the bank, deposit it, do direct deposit, cash it at the bank, it's free. And I say, no, I'm a cash guy. Banks are corporate America. I don't do banks. I don't do corporations. Those are institutions. They're big. You know, and if you listen to me long enough, I can almost convince you that there's some sense in this nonsense, right? And the truth of it is I'm on this thing called check systems, where I'm so bad with money and balancing a check account, and have bounced so many checks and, you know, screwed over so many banks, that I'm not allowed to have a checking account. I fill out the paper, they run it through check systems, everything's connected today, and it goes wah, 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 and the bank is like, sir, please leave, right? And so, but who can come to AA and just spill that out, right? Oh, I'm not allowed, so I got to go to this other place. And I got a lot of things like that, that I operate, the way that I operate in life, I've got my story for them. About being a cash guy, and I've developed a lot of these stories that we're going to unravel through this inventory process. So I'm writing down, you know, who I hate and why I hate them, and that sure was easy. And then we talked about it. I looked at it. He said, we put it aside and came back to it. And just in that little bit of my experience is that the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous happens through a pen. And I don't know why all the magic is contained in a pen, but it is. And this wasn't foreign to me, this idea of it's important to write things down. My father was in the Army, and he was structured. He was a drill sergeant and was familiar with the way of doing things. And he went on to be very successful in business. He was the president of 7-Up, the soft drink company. And every Saturday, from as far back as I can remember, I'm talking like 10 years old, it was on my list of one of the things that I hated my father for. We had family dinner at 6 o'clock. We all had to be at the table, you know, no hats, nothing. You know, you had to be there and family time. And on Sundays, we had to present my father with a list of our 10 goals for the week, and they had to be written. And my father said that goals don't exist unless they're on paper. Otherwise, they're just things in your head, and nothing in your head is real. The only example of a goal being real is if they're listed on paper. And my sister and I had to give this, you know, and I'm talking every week from 10 through middle school, through high school. And then on Saturdays, the week later, under those 10 goals, I had to leave some space. And then I had to list on Saturday, we would present my father at dinner with the three things we did that week that brought us closer to or further from meeting each of our goals. And I hated him for that, you know. And now that I'm in business and doing some stuff in my life and through Alcoholics, and I've read some outside stuff, and you know, there's all these books about 7 habits of highly effective people, and it's like, write your goals down. I'm like, man, my dad was onto something, you know? And all of a sudden, it's become a valuable life skill that I hated him for like trying to, you know, help me. But just thought it was so strict, all this help. But there's, I don't know what it is, I can't explain it, there's a certain magic when pen meets paper, and that happens time and again for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they seem to think so too, because there's many points in the book where I could point out, but you all know where they are, where they say, you know, we do this in writing, we put this down, we put it on paper. And then I took it up, and I'm sitting there, and Roger starts asking me these questions about, you know, what do you think that affects? You know, does that affect your self-esteem? How did that make you feel? Because number one on my list was this girl, Melissa. And Melissa, she, when I was in the hospital dying, she came into that hospital room. My mother was in the corner because they didn't think I was going to make it. It ended up that I did destroy my pancreas. I have another story, but some problems. And Melissa had a key to my house. She'd been living with me, much like many other names on the list. And she came in to return the key and said, "It doesn't look like you're going to be much fun anymore. I'm going with another guy," and left. And I'm thinking, like, man, talk about kicking you when you're down. And also when Melissa was, you know, used me, never paid any rent, did all my cocaine, drank everything in the refrigerator, never contributed, just likes me because of the money, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then the final line that was, you know, pretty much if you were a woman, all of my inventory ended with, you know, left me when I was down. You know, got the final blow in. And then we're looking at that, you know, what do you think that affects your self-esteem? I'm like, well, yeah, left me for another guy while I'm dying. I mean, come on. And I'm in a paper gown with my butt out. Yes, self-esteem. And he's like, well, what about your finances? You know, it seems like you don't like getting sucked in the bank account. I'm like, man, took as much money out of me as she could get. And well, what about your ambitions? We had to talk about that a little bit because I didn't even realize I had any, but it turns out that I did. And, you know, personal relationships, including sex. I'm like, well, yeah, I like my friendships. I like guys to see me with a hot chick. All my friends important to me and my friend group to, you know, have a woman with me at that point, you know, and she's got to look and act a certain way. And certainly the sex relations with her. And he's like, wow. He calls that a quadruple banger, right? So it turns out because she hit on all four areas of self that can possibly be affected. And one of the greatest things that I know about myself today that's just a working part of my life is that if something kind of is a direct hit, you know what I mean? It poof, gets me. Because, like, if anybody after the meeting last night, Jerry's like, you know, oh, you're a you goofy bald guy. That's going to... To him, what I am, I'm a bald guy. You didn't even capture my attention. You didn't offend me. You didn't upset me. You didn't, you know, that's just is what it is. But when one of those, it doesn't affect any of those four areas of self. And now I know it's like when something does kind of, you know what I'm talking about, poof, gets me. I go, why am I worked up about this? You know, why is it 4 o'clock in the afternoon and I'm thinking about this thing that happened at 9 o'clock this morning? And you guys have just taught me it's not a working part. I'm like, I think that threatened my job, you know, which means my money, which means our house, which means my daughter, which means, holy cow, am I scared? You know, moving into some fear here. This is what's going on with me because I was a guy that went through life that was never any deeper than, like, you offend me, I punch you. It's like a Cro-Magnon, basically. You know what I mean? Like, hurt me, hurt back. Right? And I don't even know why I'm doing it. You know? Said mean thing. Flattened tires. Right? And then I'm wondering why there's a warrant for flattening tires. And it's like, well, you said a mean thing to me. And I also learned through this process that I'm a person, my reaction to being offended in one of these four areas is usually, I have a disproportionate responder, if you know what I'm saying. I respond tenfold to what you did to me. Because it also talks about, you know, it doesn't mean that the world and life, things aren't going to happen, you know, seemingly to me. I have a friend that likes to say nothing happens to me, everything happens for me. And that's a nice way of looking at the world. I'd love to tell you that I could see it that way every day, but I don't. I'm not there. And when things happen, there's times when, you know, I don't have a part and they're not my fault. What am I going to do with them? And we talk about changing a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous and through the inventory process. And when I see my part and get into 6 and 7 and getting free of those things, what we don't talk a lot about is the acceptance part of stuff when things, you know, aren't my fault. And defects that just are, you know, and learning to live with them and accepting them. And, you know, on the jerk scale, I used to be a 10, man, when I got to you guys, and I'm somewhere around a 7 now. You know, and just knowing that and going, you know, it's getting better. You know, I'm not the guy I want to be yet, but I'm better than I was. And trying, we're striving for perfection, Bill says in 6 and 7, which I also think is part of our topic of inventory, because step 6 and 7 deals with the keys to the kingdom, right? We have that story in the back of the book, and, who here would like to enter the kingdom, right? Like, that's I don't even know for sure what the kingdom is, but it sounds great, I'm in. It sounds like a place of, perfect peace and no disturbance and, whatever the kingdom is, I'm in, right? But when I get to the gate, the gate's open to the kingdom, all of us are welcome all the time. But there's a guy at the gate that says, well, Rich, you can come in. There's only one rule. You can't bring any of your kingdom in here. Well, what's my kingdom? My kingdom is anything I'm in charge of, my way of doing things, my thoughts, my opinions, my political views, my way of doing life, right? Like, I've got a way. Ask my wife, God forbid you hang a blue dress shirt in the middle of the white dress shirts, my universe is off. And, and she's like, what if I just wasn't so focused on that and I could have blue and white mixed together and I wasn't disturbed, right? That would be my buddy Sandy used to always say, that's the goal. If there's the touchdown dance in AA, it's to be the least disturbed person in the room, right? All the time. Like, that's the goal. I just, no matter what happens, I want to be undisturbed. And this thing that's keeping me out, today, each of us sitting here has the chance today to live life in God's kingdom. If I'm willing to surrender enough of me to be able to enter. And all of the things, my 6 and 7 and what comes out of 4 and 5, is an understanding of some of these things that keep me from entering the kingdom. And I'm interested in being in the kingdom with you guys. I like peace and calm and happy and smooth day and no resistance. And all of my struggles come from resistance. And getting to some of that is amazing. And those fears, I too was just this scared guy that wanted you to think I'm just this tough guy, trying to pretend I'm a man. And and I don't know where I got that from, that it was important that you think I'm a stand-up man. And really, all of these fears, when you boil them down, for me, came to the last part of what they talk about in this fear inventory. Is I'll just give an example of snakes. Afraid of snakes. And he said, well, why are you afraid of snakes? I said, well, it's gonna bite me. And he said, well, if you see a snake, just jump back and just get out of the way and it won't bite you. Then you don't have to be scared of snakes. And I said, no. It's that I'm not going to be able to jump out of the way. It's going to sneak up, or I'm going to step on it in the dark, or I'm going to be going out to the shed and it's going to hang down from the rafters and get me. And so what you're telling me, Rich, is that you're scared a snake is going to bite you and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And then I'm scared of losing my job because I won't be able to pay the mortgage. We'll be homeless. Da, da, da. He goes, well, that's it. Don't be scared of that. Just don't lose your job. do a good job and don't lose your job. Then you don't have to worry about that. I go, no. You're not listening. Let me explain this to you. I'm going to do a good job. I'm going to be on time. I'm going to be the best employee in the place. And for some reason, they're going to fire me anyway. Because there's, even though I do all those things that are within my control, they're going to fire me anyway, and there's nothing I can do about it. And I'm afraid of dying because I don't, know when it's going to happen, and there could be a big heart attack or da da da. And I'm going to, not know anything. Well, just to eat right and just, don't die. I go, no, you're not listening. It's that. It's going to happen, and there's nothing I can do about it. So every fear comes down for me to that second part, and there's nothing I can do about it. Because we know from the Serenity Prayer, if there's something I should be doing, I should be doing it. But this concept of things are going to happen that I can't control, I can't take appropriate action to postpone or evade them. They're going to just happen. And then it goes on to say that we're on a different basis now. You know, this basis of trusting and relying on God. And that is a whole different basis for living life, is trusting and relying on. People say all the time, because I get to do a lot of AA stuff in Southern California. I love going surfing there. I still go into Mexico. My home group out there is the La Mesa Men's Group. We do a sober men's surf retreat down into the Baja. Every time I do it, my mother goes nuts. She's like, those guys that you work for in Mexico, isn't there still a hit out on you? You're going to die, you know, out there. Can you please not go to Southern California and certainly Mexico? And it's like, I find it hard to believe now that through all of the interaction of all the bad stuff with those guys, God somehow brought me through that. And now going out there to carry God's message in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to get shot down at the podium. Like, that sounds a little crazy now if I'm living on the basis of trusting and relying on God. And then we get to this whole, you know, sex bit and this standards, you know, that was the other thing that came out of this process that's just a working part of life for me, is who and what am I? And he would say things like, well, what is your, you know, sex standard, your relationship standard? And I don't think I have any, you know, like two eyes is good, ears, you know, breathing, I don't know. That's what I came to y'all with, you know, like just, I would have said like morally vacant, you know, and he pointed out again by looking at my own writing, which is the tricky part of this. It's hard to get out of something you wrote. He's like, well, it seems to me that, you know, you were upset at Melissa because she cheated on you. You were upset at Stephanie because she cheated on you. You were upset at Barbara because she cheated on you. You were upset at Stephanie because she cheated on you. You were upset at, you know, blah, blah, blah. You seem to have a concept somewhere deep down inside that a man and woman, when they make a commitment to each other, should honor that and not go outside of that commitment. That seems to be what's upsetting you. Would you agree with that? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, that's called monogamy. Write that down over here. And I got this thing called standard, right? And under that, I would write monogamy. But coming to you all, I would not have written that, right? And it took that inventory of me looking at that. And by the way, with all these women, this was good for me to know. He said, well, how did you meet all of these women that do these horrible things to you? Take your money, do all your cocaine, leave when times are tough. Where did you meet Melissa? And I'm like, oh, well, the same place I meet all girls, at the bar. And what do you say? You know, what's your big smooth line? You know, player. You know, what's your game? And it turns out I pretty much got one move, you know, with all women, which is like, hey, babe, leave him. Don't worry about him. I can see you're upset and he's bothering. You should come with me. I'm a big time cocaine dealer. Let's go back to my place, do some stuff, do some drinking. Come with me. Life's going to be sweet. And then I'm shocked when 3 to 6 months later, all you want is money and cocaine, right? And you've wronged me. And I just can't figure out how I could possibly be attracting women of this caliber. And so again, it just kind of ruined the whole victim thing for me. They also, you know, have that saying I love, you know, victims don't recover. You got to live in it. We also like to talk about it with Roger and I. The way it's important, if you want to stay angry about something, you have to keep talking about it. You got to tell your sponsor, you got to go to the meeting and go, listen to what Barbara did to me. And then you got to go to the next meeting because the person you told that to didn't properly respond. And you listen to what Barbara did to me. And then you got to go the next day, you call your sponsor back. You know, I saw Barbara last night. And then the next day, you know, I'm finding somebody else that I can tell about Barbara. Listen to what Barbara did. And it's very important if you want to stay angry, you got to keep that at the forefront of your mind and your heart, and you got to keep talking about it to anybody that'll listen. Because you know what might happen if you don't do that? You might forget about it and just be happy. And we don't want that to happen, right? If we're in the resentment business, you got to keep that fresh. So it turns out that some of the best gasoline to put on a resentment is continually talking about it. So we like to talk about things three times. So, okay, that's the third time. We're done with that. Through the process of where I am today, of 12 years of living this way, we call what Jerry was talking about the four-step plan for resentment, because we say, let it go, you know, like there's some, what are you doing? I'm just going to let it go. And like, what? And it turns out that that's what, you know, 4 through 9 are, is there's an actual process and some work to letting it go for somebody like me. If I had the ability to just wish it away, like I would do that. So I think a lot of times we do a newcomer a disservice when we come up and go, hey, just let it go, without telling them how. In that four-step plan, right? I gotta see where I'm like that person. The Buddhists have a name for that, you know, of developing compassion, a loving. What I really have to see is, I put my wallet down there while I come up here, and she took it. I mean, it's not there anymore. It's probably in her purse. She took my wallet. You know, there's a little bit of dough in there, and I'm mad. Well, have you ever taken anything from anybody, Rich? Well, yeah. I mean, she must have really needed that money to steal a wallet in the middle of an AA meeting. Maybe she's hungry, or rent's due, or you don't know what's going on. I mean, think how bad off she must be to steal a wallet in an AA meeting. You ever been in a place like that, Rich? Well, yeah. And I get to a true place of where I understand, and that is a lot different for a jerk of my type than walking around AA going, well, you know, I can see how she's spiritually sick, right? Which is what it says, right? We see where they're saying, oh, well, she's just sick, as if I'm somehow not, and I'm better than that, right? And I've risen to some other plane. Oh, well, you know, she's sick. Some are sicker than others, you know? That is not a true place of empathy. And when I see that, you know, of avoiding retaliation, shutting my mouth, not running around talking about her, you know, and seeing how, boy, man, this is something I sure could have done. And then I could get from that place of, you know, resentfulness to true understanding and fellowship with brotherhood, right, with man. And 12 years into practice and trying to live like this, I will tell you that you're going to, you know, hear that. I'm a pretty good amender. When I'm wrong, I've gotten really good at being wrong. And I know what to do about it because you all have showed me and taught me, and I'm quick to do that. I'm kind of a lousy forgiver. Because there's only two ways, right, that to get undisturbed in this process. And if I'm wrong, I quickly admit it. I can see that over from the fourth column. I quickly admit it and make amends. But what if that's not the case? What if it's the other? I got nothing to do with it. I was wasn't wrong. But I'm disturbed. So who cares whether I'm wrong or not? Right? The problem is I'm disturbed. How do I get undisturbed? Forgive. And that's the part we don't talk about, you know, a whole ton. You know, we focus a lot on accepting what we've done wrong and fixing it. And I've gotten pretty good at that. And I just, in all honesty, tell you that I'm better at that part of it, of getting undisturbed that way. I almost want to be wrong, right? Jeez, because I know what to do with that. But just letting you off the hook, sometimes I'm not so quick with that. So I think that's, at this point, all I want to say about inventory, other than I would tell Jim when we did this and we were going to do this fifth step at 6 and 7, I said, you know, I went to the meeting. I said, aren't we supposed to go to the beach? Because I live right at the beach too. I said, I heard him in the meeting. What we do is we go to the beach. I'm going to read this to you. We're going to set it on fire. We're going to throw it into the ocean, because that's what they said that they did. I heard several people talk about it at the meeting, and it just sounded beautiful. I mean, it was symbolic of like the death of the old life, the new life. out at Gubbins. It's like a Viking burial, right? I mean, what do you mean, come to your house? Aren't we supposed to? He goes, set it on fire, throw it into the ocean. Would you please stop going to those BB meetings? And I said, what is BB, Jim? And he goes, I don't know, but it's not AA. That list is going to be, we need to use that for what's coming next. If you set it on fire and throw it into the ocean, you're dead meat. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much for both of your sharing. And I do just want to say, I admitted the part that the reason that we're here is because we want to be here. So I just wanted to add that. So we'll take a break now. I do want to, before we take a break, pass the seventh tradition basket. And while the seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, while contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local service, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. So just for those of you who were not here last night, there was some great sharing that occurred, and you can listen to it online at simpleactions.net. It may not be up for maybe until the Monday or so. Just keep that in mind. And at this point, we'll break, and turn me back at, we'll start again at 10:30. Thank you.